Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 10, delivered on February 18, 2010. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. This is a very important topic. I make it relatively short. I cut to the chase so that you will know exactly what it is I expect you to know, so that when you use the CAPM, the results you get, you will be able to interpret in the correct way. First things first about the CAPM. The purpose is to get an interest rate. But remember, interest rate can be also be called a yield, a discount rate. All kinds of different words mean the same thing to us, interest rate. For the purposes of CAPM, we are deriving what is called a discount rate. An interest rate that we will use for discounting future expected cash flows back to the present. And in some cases, taking present cash flows and carrying them forward. But principally, in business and in investments, we are using CAPM to get an interest rate that we will then apply to future expected cash flows to find what their equivalent value is here in the present. Now, we get to that a little bit later with the time value of money and project analysis and all of that. So here is the machinery that is necessary for us to move forward in the course. I gave you the essential formula of CAPM. There's not much point in motivating it at this level. Certainly in a higher powered investments course, I would go behind the curtain and say, well, this is how the CAPM is developed and all that. In a grad level course, you'll see some harebrained variations on the capital asset pricing model. One in particular is called the APT, the arbitrage pricing theory. Don't ever use it. If I catch you using APT instead of CAPM, I will hunt you down and beat you with a rake like a dog. Don't use it. CAPM, it's very simple and is very good. Until something comes along that proves to me that CAPM is no longer the formula of choice, it is the formula of choice. Here we go. The discount rate, the rate of return, we expect from a security. Case of S. I keep writing R's. It's just an old habit. Will equal the risk-free rate. If you cannot get at least the risk-free rate on a security, there is no reason for that security to live. So every security must deliver at least the risk-free rate. Why would you invest in anything if it did not return as much as the safest thing out there? And again, remember that the risk-free rate we usually proxy by a short-term T-bill. Those are as risk-free as you can get. Notwithstanding Moody's threat just yesterday, two days ago, that it was considering downgrading the rating of the debt of the United States. Did any of you see that a couple of days ago? Moody's said that they are so concerned about the federal budget deficits that they're considering downgrading the quality, the rating of the debt of the United States government. This being the same Moody's which for years coddled businesses by misrepresenting the risks that were inherent in their securities. This being the same Moody's whose internal machinery seemed to sit on its fat ass for 8 long years while the federal deficits went up and up and up, and suddenly now they're getting morally righteous. Whatever. Plus, the risk-free rate plus, we are going to take a magnification factor called beta. It is characteristic of the security. You can go to all kinds of investment resources, online, in paper, and find the beta of stocks. Times the expected rate of return to a market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Now, this K sub M minus K sub F, this quantity that is multiplying, that is being multiplied by beta, we call this the market premium. And I'll put in parentheses, over risk-free. This is the additional reward that you get for investing in the widest, broadest-based portfolio possible instead of the risk-free portfolio. Now, this represents K sub M minus K sub F represents the reward for the additional reward for bearing the non-diversifiable risk of the market portfolio. This isn't the reward for bearing risk. This is the reward for bearing non-diversifiable risk. The market is not going to reward you for bearing diversifiable risk. You don't get rewarded for being stupid unless you are making movies like Jackass. Have any of you ever been on YouTube? You can do stupid things and get on YouTube. It can go viral. Do you get a reward for that? Not really. You get a lot of cred, but no reward. K sub M minus K sub F is the reward to bearing the extra non-diversifiable risk of the market portfolio. Now remember, this market portfolio is a theoretical animal. It is an expected return. Now, in theory, the market portfolio would be built by taking every investment there is and putting it into your portfolio in proportion to its contribution to the proportion of the entire global economy, or the national economy, however you want to see it. That would be rather difficult to do, I assure you, to go out there and get every stock, even to just get every stock there is. That would just be ridiculous. But you don't have to. Do you remember the rule of thumb number that I gave you last time on what would be a portfolio, how many stocks would be in a portfolio that would remove almost all, virtually all the non-diversifiable risk, how many stocks it would take? No. I threw it out just kind of offhand. What was it? 30. About 30. Really? 20 to 30. And I mean, you've shaken out most of the non-diversifiable risk. You get an index portfolio of the S&P 500. That is, that's got most of the non-diversifiable risk shaken out of it. Even the Dow would be a highly diversified, it would be diversified enough to shake out the non-diversifiable risk. However, you have to be a little careful with when I throw out those kind of indices. They are not necessarily truly representative. Like, for example, if I said the Dow, that's the 30 big, huge, 800-pound gorilla companies. That doesn't include a lot of big companies, medium-sized companies, and the millions and millions of tiny companies out there. So it's kind of tilted towards the big. The S&P 500, That's more representative, but that one still doesn't include all the millions of very small companies out there. The NASDAQ, well, that's an enormous spread of stocks. If you got a NASDAQ index, but it's tilted towards the small companies. So, I mean, really, what would be a good one to use? Probably the S&P 500, because really it sweeps through a large percentage of the global economy, enough that it's fairly representative. However, a caution here, K-M is not the return that the Standard & Poor's got you last year. If you were to choose the Standard & Poor's as your proxy for K-M, the return to the Standard & Poor's portfolio, you look last year, that would not be K-M. Now, a lot of times we'll use something like that, but that's not really what K-M is all about. K-M is an expected. So we look at the Standard & Poor's last year, what it returned. That's going to actually be biased probably to the low side. What we really want to know is, what does the market expect the Standard & Poor's 500 index portfolio to do this coming year? It's an expected. History is not the future. And especially in a time like this, when last year, the last couple of years have really sucked as far as the stock market goes. So you always have to be careful about how you pull your numbers. Now, I'm not going to do anything like find some numbers for me. I'll give you the numbers to use in it. For now, if you get me in an investments course, we dig a little deeper and we try to look more at what the expectations of the markets are going forward. However, beta generally is a number greater than or equal to zero. If beta sub S equals zero, that would tell us that the security has no relationship to the market premium. All you will get for a reward, all you should expect for a reward for this security, for its non-diversifiable risk, is nothing but the risk-free rate. A T-bill would have a beta of approximately zero. This zero means there is no non-diversifiable risk, so you aren't going to get any reward. Now, if I had a stock, suppose I had a stock with a beta of 1.0. Suppose I had a stock with a beta of 1.0. Let me try this. That would mean I could buy this stock and I would have the same as the market portfolio. Would that be right? Look, let me work it out. See, in that case, K-S would be K-F plus 1.0 times K-M minus K-F. So if I do some algebra here, K-S is K-F plus 1.0 times K-M minus 1.0 times K-F. So K-S equals K-M. So what would be wrong with the logic of just saying, all I have to do is find a stock with a beta of exactly 1.0 and buy that and I'll have the market portfolio? What's wrong with that logic? It's okay if you don't see this. That's why I'm doing this lecture, is to get you to see this. Anyone got a guess? Go ahead. No, you should expect, according to CAPM, that it would deliver to you the market rate, which would be better than the risk-free rate, we should hope. In fact, here's the thing. A single stock has enormous diversifiable risk. All CAPM talks about is non-diversifiable risk. That does not mean that if I have a stock that has a beta of 1, It is exactly as risky as the market portfolio. The market portfolio is so diversified that all of the non-diversifiable risk is all the diversifiable risk is gone. But if I buy a single stock with a beta of 1, it has wild amounts of diversifiable risk. You could take an ass bath with that stock. Well, at least I was expecting to get the market rate of return. It doesn't matter. You are bearing enormous diversifiable risk by holding one security. All beta does is talk to you about the non-diversifiable risk. Okay? Keep that in mind. I do ask questions. I probe that so that you know there is a misunderstanding of that idea of what beta tells you. Now, however, we can do some interesting things understanding. So, for example, if I had a security that had a beta between 0 and 1, the non-diversifiable component of that security's risk would be less than the market portfolio's risk. Understanding that the market portfolio has only non-diversifiable risk because it's so huge there is no diversifiable risk. So let me qualify it, make that qualifier, but let me repeat the first part again. A stock that has a beta between 0 and 1, its non-diversifiable risk is less than the market portfolio's. So if you formed your own portfolio of 30, 40 stocks, and the aggregate beta of your portfolio was, let's say, 0.75, that would tell you that your portfolio has a non-diversifiable risk of about 75% of the market portfolio. It would still have some residual diversifiable risk, but if you've got that many stocks, it's negligible at that point. So if I told you that we have a stock, like, for example, let us say an Amazon.com, and I'm just speculating here, with a beta of 0.6, with a beta of 0.6, and I could very well do this. Remember, I don't know if you know this, but you have essay questions on my exams, which really sucks. But believe me, it sucks for me too, grading. You know, considering I'm a former English teacher, I have to go through and mark your comma splices. Talk to me. What does it mean to have a stock? Let's say it's Amazon.com. We find that its beta is 0.6. Tell me what that means. You're my investment guru. I look to you as a shining light. What does it mean?
It means that the non-diversifiable risk is less than the market portfolio risk.
Not bad. Flesh it out. Would you like to? Hell no. You're like, no. Go away, pervert. Let me tune it up, okay? If Amazon.com were to have a beta, the common stock of Amazon.com were to have a beta of 0.60, that would mean that Amazon.com's non-diversifiable risk, non-diversifiable volatility, if you will, is 60% of the market portfolio's non-diversifiable risk. But of course, the market portfolio has only non-diversifiable risk, so I can put it a little bit more simply. If Amazon.com has common stock has a beta of 0.6, then that means that the non-diversifiable component of Amazon.com's stock has 60% of the risk of the market portfolio. In other words, I could look at Amazon.com's volatility, its stock price, and you know what I probably would see? It would probably be a lot more violent than the market portfolios, than the Standard & Poor's. If I were to look at a stock with a beta of 0.6, just look at the raw stock data over time, I would see Amazon.com or any stock with a beta of 0.6 would have a whipsaw considerably stronger, possibly, than the market portfolio. But it's got a 0.6. That says it's only 60% as volatile, right? But when I look at Amazon.com's stock price, there's diversifiable risk in there too. There's volatility in there that goes away if you have that stock in a well-diversified portfolio. So when I just look at a stock, its volatility will be carrying both a non-diversifiable component and a diversifiable component. What beta tells us is the component that you will expect a reward for bearing, not the entire volatility, but only the component for which you should expect a reward for bearing. That's why you'll see low beta stocks that look pretty volatile, because they're carrying what we see with our eyes is the entire volatility. Part of it is stuff that you are not going to get rewarded for because it wouldn't be there in a well-diversified portfolio. So now, let's go on and just finish this up. We've got, suppose you had a beta of, let's say, 2.5. We have a stock with a beta of 2.5. Now let's try this one more time. See if we can get this to the point where I don't ever bother people hiding up there, so I'm going to go up here. Madam, go ahead, make my day, bring it. Okay, what does it mean? This stock, this is Al's National Junkyards. I'm Al. I sell stock. Now, tell me what that beta of my stock means.
That means that it has a very high fluctuation because of the added risk.
Okay. Get more technical with me.
The beta is...
Okay. Walk with me. This stock, 2.5, what is that as a percentage, 2.5?
Percentage?
Yeah, what's 2.5 as a percentage?
25.
Grr, 250.
Okay.
250%. Okay. This stock has what percentage of the non-diversifiable risk of the market portfolio? Tell me what percentage it has.
250.
Yes. Does it have 250%? Is it 250% as volatile as the market portfolio?
No.
Good. What part is 250% as volatile as the market portfolio? It's... Say it.
Non-diversifiable risk.
Good. Its non-diversifiable risk component is 250% as volatile as the market portfolio's. You see that distinction there? Because its total volatility is probably so big, it's like, technically we say yeehaw. But the part that is not diversifiable, that I could not get rid of in a broad-based portfolio, whipsaws 250% of the market portfolio's whipsaw. Okay? You follow that distinction there? Okay, now when I ask this on an exam, and I will ask this. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Okay? Trust me. Those eyes are so blue, man. Where the hell? I mean, it's just like they're glowing. It's scary. Don't ever be a zombie. You could eat a lot of people because they'd just be staring at your eyes while you ate them. I don't know what the hell that meant. I've lost my train of... Okay.
So a beta of 2.5, what does that
mean? Means that that stock has a non-diversifiable component of its risk that is 250% of the market portfolios. Therefore, you should expect the premium over risk-free holding this stock in a portfolio to be 250% of the market premium over risk-free. So if the market, if I expect the market this coming year to have a return of 15%, the market's return for next year, the expected return to the market portfolio is 15%. And this Treasury bills are coming off at about, short-term T-bills are coming off with an annual yield, let's say, of 3%. Then a beta of 0 would imply that the return to that security, the beta of a stock is 0, the return to that security should be, you don't even have to calculate it. What should it be? Come on. What should it be? Risk-free rate. It has a beta of 0. You ain't going to get any reward other than risk-free, the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. So, and we can calculate it out here. K sub S is going to be the K sub F, 3% plus 0% times, I'm sorry, 0, not 0%, 0 times 15% less 3%. So, surprise, surprise, you're going to get risk-free on a stock that has, you should expect risk-free on a beta of 0 stock. Suppose that we had a beta, I'm sorry, that should be beta of 0. Suppose that we have a beta of a stock is exactly 1.0. What should you expect to get for that stock? Yes, the market premium. You should get the market because it's got a beta of 1. So we work that one through, K sub S, just to make sure, do a reality check, 3% plus 1.0 times 3%, 15% less 3%. And if you work out the math of it, well, surprise, surprise, if you do go through the grinder, you come up with 15%. The expected return to this security in a diversified portfolio would be the market. Ah! What the? Boy, what did I do? That almost softened my stool. Well, that's going to sound good on there. It sounds like I'm going through a meat grinder. Did I do something? Oh, thought they were trying to tell me it's time for me to be a PowerPoint professor like everyone else. Now, class, we are going to turn off the lights and look at a PowerPoint. Click, click. Any questions? Thank you. Goodbye. I'm sorry. I shouldn't do that. Last thing before I quit this. You know what? Remember how I was talking about beta 0, beta 1, beta, and all those kinds of betas? You know, there are actually some securities that have negative betas. There are actually securities that have negative betas. And I actually know some investors. Now, you're not going to see huge negative betas. But you might see a beta of negative 0.1, negative 0.3, negative 0.8. I know some investors who actually aim at those securities. They're called, they come under different names. One of my good friends, he called them contrarian stocks. Because they actually have a volatility that's counter to the market. They are what you take if you are a total pessimist and you think that whatever the market thinks is going to happen isn't what's going to happen, or if you think that the market's going to go to hell. These are stocks that actually run, their volatility actually runs counter to the market. Now, here's some that would do it. Typically, where we see negative betas, sometimes in gold mining stocks, you'll see negative betas, slightly negative betas. In other words, when the economy is doing great, gold goes to hell. When the economy heads for the crapper, gold becomes quite popular. Right now, you probably a lot of people keep sending me emails saying, you know, I've heard that gold is a great investment. Don't you think you should buy it? And I say, you stupid asshole. The people who are trying to sell you gold are the ones who are trying to get out of it. Don't do that. If you think gold is great, that's because the rich people are trying to sell it to the suckers now. But the reality is that some gold mining stocks and some other stocks do have slightly negative betas. Kind of an interesting thing. And in fact, there are some mutual funds that are called contrarian funds or contra funds, sometimes they're called, that actually they form their portfolios, their diversified portfolios, with negative beta stuff. So if you are a contrarian, if you believe that everyone around you is wrong, and that the economy, especially if you think the economy is going to go to hell when everyone else thinks it's going to do okay, this might be where you want to head, is towards a portfolio, well diversified of course, of betas that are around zero and negative. Because then you would be rolling the dice against the herd. The problem with rolling the dice against the herd is, you know what can happen when you run against a big herd? You can get trampled to death by the stampede. Because even if they're going off the cliff and you're running the other way, you can say, ha ha, ha ha, you're all going off the cliff, but you see they'll run over you and you'll be dead. Okay? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.